I'm very pleased to be here. It's fun to see a couple faces that I've known in other parts of the world that I didn't expect to be here. That's one of the perks of getting to travel around. I was on a subway in South Korea, and a young man sat down beside me, and I felt like he was staring at me. Do you know the feeling? You can just sort of feel when someone is just staring at you. And I didn't know whether to say hello or ignore him or if he was something wrong with him. And pretty soon he goes, and I looked at him and he said, "Are you by any chance Dr. Taylor?" And I thought, oh, good grief. Keeps me from sinning. Not that I want to. Because you never know who you're going to see who knows you. He said, "I was a teenager in Michigan when I heard you speak." I've been around since the late 1800s. He said, "That's the reason I'm in Korea doing mission work." I nearly started tearing up in the subway. So I hope some of this new brain function research will help you understand that everything starts in the brain. And if you think you can, or if you think you can't, you're right. And as the pastor said, research shows that this right frontal lobe behind your right eye is where intuition is and where we receive impressions. And likely that is how the Holy Spirit connects with us. So, Thomas Edison, no, I didn't know him personally, thought the brain was so important. He said the body's main task is to carry your brain around. Will you look at that and make sure it's actually working? Are the hands moving? Okay. I just want to double check. I like to see a clock, so I pace how many stories I get to tell you. Because there's no time in the right hemisphere, none whatsoever. I could stand up here till I got tired or hungry and talk to you, and I would be oblivious to the passage of time. So I need to have something that helps me. Okay, so the reason that you keep your body healthy, and we'll talk a little bit about that today, is because you need your brain to have a vehicle to move around. Without your body, your brain could never go from one place to the other except in your mind. But the reason you keep your brain healthy is because what's the point of hauling around a brain that isn't working? So it's really 1, 2 equals the whole. All right. The most difficult thing you'll ever do in life, according to some researchers, is get married and live with someone for the rest of your life. They also show that it is the most rewarding thing you can do if you do it right. And that means that you don't get married when you're 17 and your corpus callosum that connects your two hemispheres isn't even paved yet and won't be paved for another 4 or 5 years. In fact, your prefrontal cortex right behind your eyes that has all those executive functions, decision-making, willpower, imagination, all of those things, it's not even done until late 20s. And many people have already made life-changing decisions long before that. And they wake up one morning when they're about 30 and go, "What are all these people doing in my house?" Because if I was making decisions now, none of them would be here. Not that I don't love them, but they wouldn't be here. Not even the dog or the parrot. But they made decisions before their brain was really mature. One of the big problems, now let me make sure that this is on. It's not reaching. Okay, just advance it for me, and if we can figure it out, that would be great. The battery's okay because I've got the I just may have to wave at you and we'll figure it out later. All right. One of the big problems in relationships, no surprise, is that males and females approach managing stress very differently. Now, the pastor already thinks that men handle stress better than women. I have to have a talk with him. Neither one of us does it better. We do it differently. And if you don't understand that, it's a big cause for people breaking up. This is not a stress management seminar. But let me point out to you that you can lump stressors into three categories. Eustress, which helps you grow, helps you learn. I'm under eustress today because I'm up here presenting. I love it. I want to do it. There's still a little extra angst from doing that because you know right off the bat not everybody's going to like what you say. And so you have to be healthy enough to let that go. Just put it out there like a buffet and people take what they need. It's very positive, stress, if your life is in balance. And then there's distress, which you'd like to avoid if you possibly could. And I've just been through three evacuations, four smoke, fire a mile and a half from my house, PG&E deciding to turn off all the electricity for X number of days, which was very interesting. Reminded me of Little House on the Prairie. Not that I was there either, but... And then you come to mistress and notice how it's spelled. I was talking about this one time and a voice way back in the audience said, I know all about mistress. My husband's had three of them. I think that was in the nature of distress personally, but. Now, if you don't know how to manage distress and mistress and keep your life in balance for eustress, you can actually kill brain cells, damage body organs, and shorten your life. Next, because this is not working. Because every brain on the planet is unique, and I think that's kind of fun, there's never been a brain like yours, ever. There'll never be another one again. So if you fail to use yours by design, and give what you can to improve the planet, everybody's going to lose because nobody else can do exactly what you do. Stress reactions are typically learned in childhood by watching the big people in your life and how they act and behave. It's usually related to flexibility. People who are inflexible tend to perceive much more stress than others. You can trigger it yourself in many different ways. I think that's, you know, scripture tells us what to do. It doesn't always tell us the reason. Now we have brain function information that tells us the reason. And we're going to talk about some of that in the next section. In that, we're told to forgive everyone, including ourselves. Okay, that's not always easy to do, but why in the world is that important? Because it has a direct link to your health. But we didn't know that until the 21st century. And if you've learned dysfunctional ways of dealing with stress, those can be relearned. Next, please. Males and females all experience stress. Probably equally, but not necessarily at the same time in life, and not about the same things. Males are very stressed by work issues in terms of large sample studies. Unemployment, can't find a job, get fired, have to file bankruptcy. And believe it or not, females, they are more stressed by separation and divorce than our females. They don't have the same kind of support system in general that females do. So they actually have a much worse time with separation and divorce, and often they thought everything was going along fine. And then she files for divorce because she's unhappy and they get blindsided. It's a lack of communication often. Women don't honestly and gently ask for what they want. They figure somebody ought to figure it out. Their parents did. And you can't expect another brain to figure out what your brain wants and needs. Every brain is different. That's nuts. Females, although they don't particularly like separation and divorce, because they often have much less financial support after divorce, that's not what bothers them as much as conflict. In general, they hate conflict unless they were raised to engage in it. They get stressed by serious illnesses in themselves and in others. They get stressed by separation because of death, not because of divorce as much, and so on and so forth. So you can see there's some differences. Next. Maybe I'll just start waving at you. Now, here's what the research is showing. Male brains appear to struggle less with stress, as the pastor so kindly pointed out, in the moment. Get that? But they are much more likely to have a serious stress-related depressive event, you know, a quarter of a century later in life. So it all averages out the same. It's just that they don't find it so stressful right now, and then they're at higher risk for a major depressive event. I find that interesting because if they really understood the effect of something in the moment, I don't know what happened to the armed services. Because here's these brains that aren't done yet, and they're just clamoring to put a uniform on and go to Pakistan and Iraq and wherever. And then they come back with PTSD or don't come back at all, and they had no idea how stressful it was going to be. Females tend to struggle with stress in the moment more than males do. And they're twice as vulnerable to any stress-related disorders. And two that we've worked with a long time when I was still working with Adventist Health before I retired and get to do this full-time is PTSD and depression. But they don't seem to have the midlife depressive episodes like males do. Next. Well, the light's still on, but nobody's home. Okay. Now, the brain. Everything starts in the brain. It's the first body system to recognize a stressor. And as several researchers have pointed out, there's no stress until an individual brain looks at an event and decides this is really stressful. Now, sometimes the event itself can be stressful, but that's a very small amount of the time. As soon as the brain recognizes a stressor, it triggers the stress response. And out come pouring hormones and chemicals and all kinds of things like adrenaline and cortisol and CRF, and we'll talk about that one a little bit, that changes your body chemistry completely. Takes 72 hours for all of those hormones and chemicals to rebalance themselves. And if, before the end of the 72 hours, you have another stress episode, or you do a Broadway-winning presentation to whoever will listen to you about the awful thing that's happening, you'll re-trigger the stress response. I tell you, I'm sure I have met people who have been in the stress response their entire lives. And that is not what Scripture advises for us. Next. Researchers actually began looking at this because in large sample observational studies, they found that when females say, "Oh, I'm so stressed," and first of all, you never want to tell your brain what you don't wish to be true. Got it? So if you say, "Oh, I'm so stressed," your brain goes, "Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay, let me give you the symptoms that go along with that." You only tell your brain what you want it to do. But a woman will say, "I'm kind of stressed." And usually someone will say to her, "It's not. Well, that's too strange. Oh, I'm not stressed. The person who's stressed is the one who's going to be watching me to wave at them." So women will often be told, "I don't think it's a big deal. Just get over it." Okay, that just adds to her stress. But on the other hand, if a male begins to say, "Oh, I'm pretty stressful, feel awful," then some female is likely to look at him and say, "Well, for heaven's sake, pull yourself together. That's no big deal. What's the problem?" And that's equally unhelpful. And part of that is because we really don't understand each other's differences. Now, research. Male-female differences exist in the way they approach stress management, period. But not just for the present, but for down the line. Next. Let's talk just a little bit about the stress response.
Even to do the laser?
If the laser's working, I can point a couple things out. If it isn't, you'll just have to be really clear. All right. One of those chemicals that's produced, oh, you're wonderful, thank you. I've done this in buildings a lot longer than this, so I don't know what's happening, but you know what? That'll make sure nobody falls asleep back there. So that's probably a good thing. Here is a cutaway of the brain. If you cut the brain through from the nose back, I asked my artist to pull the layers apart because you can talk about the brain in terms of three functional layers. So you can see that if you push this one up there and this one up there, you'd see that typical cutaway of the brain. The first layer is called the reptilian layer because that's all reptiles have. And of course, we do have key functions down there, including the stress response, like fight, flight, tend, befriend, conserve, withdraw. The mammalian layer in the middle is called mammalian because all mammals have it. Are we mammals? Yes, so we have the mammalian layer. And here is the big brain reward system that's involved with every addictive behavior we have ever studied. These two layers, one and two, are completely subconscious. I find that fascinating. Because in this mammalian layer is not only where we relapse into addictive behaviors if we're not clearly thinking in the third layer, but that's where we get phobias, and that's where we want relationships. So developing relationships is in a part of the brain that's subconscious. No wonder we get attracted to somebody for unknown reasons, and then if we're not careful down the line, we find that that was not a good thing to develop as a long-term friendship. I have lots of questions that research hasn't answered yet. And then you come up to the neocortex. Right here behind your forehead is where we have conscious thought. 80% of the neocortex is also subconscious. So the subconscious is much bigger than the conscious part. And it's more powerful than the conscious part. So as soon as the brain recognizes a stressor, The hypothalamus, which is in that middle layer, pours out something called CRF, corticotropin-releasing factor. It's one of the most powerful substances in the brain and body. It's both a neurotransmitter and a hormone. And if you've forgotten biology and chemistry from high school, a neurotransmitter will impact every neuron in your body, brain, spinal cord, gut, that has as many neurons as your brain, your solar plexus, your heart. And the hormone will affect every other cell in your body. So this is so powerful, it will impact every single cell in your body, and that's why the stress response, when unmanaged, is deleterious to your health. Next. Now, as soon as this CRF is released, it goes down to this alarm center in the brain stem and creates what's called an emotional arousal throughout the entire body. It's very helpful in the immediate present if it's a bona fide danger. Otherwise, it can lead to depression, among other things. So the research is that runaway CRF is a core feature of depression. So people who experience depression probably were stressed and triggering the stress response, whether they understood that or not. Next. Because this is so powerful, I want to just list some of the things it does, because it's worth paying attention to learning how to manage stressors for this alone. It suppresses appetite, meaning the body says in the brain, we got this problem, okay, forget about eating. You know, forget about this, forget about getting pregnant, forget about all kinds of things that the brain decides at the moment are ancillary activities. But now they're linking it with anorexia nervosa. And so you ask people who are struggling with that, what are you stressed about? Nothing. And so those are the wrong kinds of questions. We had to learn to ask different questions because those two seem to be linked. It increases how bad you think everything is, subjective anxiety, which leads to depression. It's linked with euphoric feelings that accompany alcoholism, which is why it's so difficult to change behaviors related to alcohol. Because alcohol is a pure brain toxin, period, in any amount. So the research says, take a little red wine with dinner. It'll help you fall asleep. Yeah, it will. But it will also wake you up after a few hours and give you a terrible quality of sleep. So it is a toxin, and because of that, the minute any alcohol enters the body, the brain pours out CRF. It's a stressor. So we don't know the length of time, but a few seconds, maybe a few minutes, after a person starts drinking, they get this moment of euphoria. Everything feels wonderful. Because the brain goes, this is a stressor. We got to do something to combat it. But there's not a brain on the planet that knows when that moment of euphoria ceases. And now you start getting all the problems associated with this toxic substance. It triggers inflammation, which is now being linked potentially with the development of all types of arthritis and multiple sclerosis. And high levels have been found in the cerebral spinal fluid of people who tried to commit suicide or who did so successfully. So it's amazingly powerful. Next. Rats make wonderful research subjects. Under the microscope, you can't even tell the difference between a rat neuron and a human neuron. Even though parts of the brain in the rat, of course, look a little different. They have no prefrontal cortex, let's face it. But there are many similarities, so they make very, very good subjects. Many of the peptides, substances that impact mood, are identical. And you can train rats to do thinking types of activities. not in the way the prefrontal cortex works, but you put them in a maze, and they can learn it in minutes and then be running through it, you know, at very fast speeds for a little rat. You put a human in the same maze, life size, and 3 days later they haven't found their way out. So they can do some things very well. The takeaway is, if someone calls you a rat, say thank you. Because they do some things faster than we do. Next. So here's how the researchers wanted to see, you know, they do research on stress, but then they want to compare. And who better to compare than a group of males with a group of females? So they took a bunch of rats, half male and half female. Rats are good swimmers. I didn't know that either. They took wine barrels, filled them about half full of water, dumped the rats in a bunch of these barrels. The water was too deep for them to reach the bottom, but it was too low for them to reach the top. So they started swimming. They swam and they swam and they swam. And they could swim for up to 48 hours. Ask yourself how you would do swimming in a big vat of water for 48 hours. But as they began to get tired, they fished them out. And fortunately, with scanning equipment now, we can look at a brain and a person or an animal while they're still alive and see what's happening next. So here is a drawing of a female rat neuron. And you can see these little things around the edge of the membrane, and those are called receptor molecules. If you don't know that term, just think of them as windows into the cell. You will see some little green arrestins in the middle that are nice and pretty. But here's the deal. In the female brain, they're doing zip, nada, nothing. They're just sitting there looking pretty. So when that rat gets stressed, that female rat, and begins to pour out all these hormones, these windows all stay open, if you will, and as the CRF comes to it in the bloodstream, all of it pours into the cell, which actually makes the brain's stress reaction more reactive. Have I said that in a way that makes sense? So let's say that here is neutral, and the female rat's way up here. The stress is horrible, because all of it is being taken into the cell. Next slide. Now, let's see what happens in the male rat brain. And by the way, you're doing really well. Thank you. So here are the same receptor molecules, but in that brain, those arrestins are doing something. They're slamming the window shut and pulling them into the cell. What does that mean? It means when the same amount of CRF reaches the rat brain neuron, only half of it gets into the cell. This one's already in, this one's coming in, there's another one coming in. And because of that, the male brain doesn't think it's so bad because it's only got half of the alertness chemical. Okay, got it? Up and down means yes. Okay. Because you got to get it if you understand this. All right, next. So here's the comparison. Here's the female rat neuron. All the windows are open. All the CRF is pouring into the cell. It's fairly vibrating with stress. Here's the male rat neuron. Only about half of the windows are open. The others have been slammed shut and pulled inside. So, you know, it may not be wonderful, but it's not the end of the world. Now, you look in real life, you can see this absolutely everywhere. One day in my office at St. Helena Hospital, a couple walked into my office. Big, tall man, hands in his pockets. He walks in, nods, and goes and looks out the window. The woman comes in, steam's coming out of her ears. I don't know these people. So I said, hi, what can I do for you? She goes, I'm going to leave him. And I'm thinking, I'm not a divorce lawyer. I'm not a counselor. And I said, okay, what's the problem? He wants his mother to move in with us. I thought, okay, she is vibrating. I said, so tell me about your mother-in-law. She's never liked me. I don't do anything right. If he moves her into our house to save money so he doesn't have to subsidize an apartment for her, I'm gone. He can just enjoy living with his mother. Okay, he hasn't said a word. So I said, I don't even know their names yet. So I said, well, sir, tell me about your mother. He's looking out the window still. He goes, well, okay, she's a bit difficult. I left home when I was 15. But come on, she's 84. How long can she live? Long enough for you to get a divorce, pal. She could live to be 110. That's an example of the difference. She's leaving. How long can she live? So, it's important to understand that every time a family has a what they perceive as a stressor, so that you can understand the reason the male brains are going, ah, come on, not that bad, get over it. You know, it'll be gone in a few weeks. And she's going, I can't live like this. It's all because of the way the brain interacts. Next slide. Deborah Bangasser, wonderful researcher on stress management, says the female brain alarm system is more sensitive to stressors and to CRF, period, even when there isn't any stressor. And people say to me, well, why is that? And I go, hey, I didn't do the design. But I'm wondering if it's because that in most cultures, women are pretty much ascribed the child care piece. And even in elementary schools, 80% of elementary school teachers are female. And you who have had children know that you can be looking right at them and they can get in trouble. And I remember one night I left my family to go do a seminar. So my husband's there, three boys. I come back 2 hours later and it looked like a bomb hit the room. And I said, what's been going on here? And my husband looks up, smiles. He's been reading his book. He says, we're doing fine, thank you. Well, if I'd been there, we would never have gotten to that level of chaos. But it's just different. All right, next slide. Because of this, what's called receptor internalization, they're pulling in those windows, the male brain just doesn't even get it at the level that a female brain will. It's not good or bad. It is different. But here's the deal. Males have an increased risk for a major depressive event 25 years later. And those of you women who have lived through a spouse in profound depression know that that's stressful in itself. Next. So the researchers wanted to know, what's the risk? I mean, why don't we see more women are diagnosed with depression? That doesn't mean they have more. It means they actually will go to the doctor. And because depression in males is so different from females with entirely different symptoms, and because doctors in school learned the stress symptoms for females and thought it applied to everybody, they miss it. You know, the research is that it takes, I don't know, like 3 years and 10 different doctors, or 10 years and 3 different doctors, I don't remember which, for a male to get diagnosed with depression. And now they're starting to teach the difference in symptoms, and that's going to help. So University of Michigan, they wanted to study perceived life, stressful life events, and the risk of a major depressive event. And so they looked at all of these males and females, and they broke the data out by gender and by race. There was no difference in women for a risk of a major depressive episode 25 years later. Did not increase depression rates in women at all. When they did interviews, they figured out that this may be because women tend to use coping strategies such as relational connections. They did a study in the United States, and they asked women, when a stressful event occurs, how many people do you know that you feel you could call and say, talk to me about this, help me with this, you know, I'm really stressed? How many did the women say? 9. 9 people they could call. Now they asked the men, if you're in a stressful situation, you've been fired, whatever, how many people do you feel comfortable calling and saying, I'm really feeling stressed, I need to talk about it, I need some help? How many did they say? 0. And if they named 1, and 1 was the most in the study that was named, that person, who was that person? Their spouse. Now, are you starting to see the links? That's why divorce is worse on men than women, because if he had a supportive spouse and now she's gone, he's got zip. And everybody needs somebody. And 2/3 of the people in churches in the United States, regardless of denominations, are female. Men don't find themselves in church. And often, I'm really proud of your pastor. He's at least sitting down in here. I don't know if he's listening, but he's here. What? My dad had a good sense of humor. I know I take a risk when I walk into a church. I've never met the pastor before, and I'm risking teasing him from the front. But he can handle it. But in many churches, 1/3 are men, but they're not in the audience. They're out in the foyer, you know, walking around, you know, making sure everything's all right. They're there to attain a goal rather than develop a relationship. It's very interesting what studies are showing. Next, please. So then they've come to what they're calling the black-white paradox, and I think this is staggering. Researchers found, well, bottom line is men had a much higher risk by gender for this midlife depression. But then when you broke it out by blacks and whites, and those are the first two they've studied, they found that the white males had a much higher risk for midlife depressive event than black males. Now they decided we got to figure this out. So they went through a similar process of surveys and interviewing and so on. And they found that black males have not only disproportionately lower rates of depression, even though statistically, because of the racial relationships in most countries, black males actually have higher levels of stressful events. The black males tend to implement adaptive coping strategies that white guys don't. And you can look around and see evidence of this. You'll see a bunch of black kids, you know, playing basketball together on the corner lot. Sometimes you'll see white guys doing that, but not nearly at the rate you'll see for black kids. They have positive reappraisals, meaning they talk to each other more about what's going on. You know, white males, I remember my husband, you know, going hunting once. He decided it wasn't for him, but he went hunting with a group of guys. And when they came back, I said, well, how did it go? Good. Well, what did you do? Hunted. Well, not all day and all night. Well, we cooked over the campfire and then went to bed. So what did you talk about? He goes, what? We didn't talk. We were hunting. So here they are, 4 days together, and they haven't talked. They're not talking to each other about the issues. And women's ministries has been around for mega longer than men's ministries. I was asked to speak at the annual male ministries retreat for the Central California Conference not too long ago. Only female on the campus. And it was really interesting to talk to these guys about things like this and how uncomfortable they were even addressing it. Where did that come from? Did it come from mothers telling their little boys to suck it up and be a man? Don't know where it came from, but you white guys need to look at this. I was in New Orleans not too long ago at Preservation Hall. Any of you ever been there? It's wonderful. I'd been told about it, so I was lecturing there. Not too long before, you know, that horrible hurricane and flood and everything. So I wanted to go to Preservation Hall, found my way there. As I recall, it's off Bourbon Street somewhere, and it's not a big room. It's probably half this stage and the depth of the stage again. So that's not a very big room. No chairs, standing room only. It starts at 9 o'clock, but if you're not there at 8, you won't even get in the door. So I'm standing there and waiting. About 2 minutes to 9, the door opens, and out walks these five black guys. And the first guy was on a cane, and he was walking like this. I kid you not. And I'm going, great Scotland Yard, what's happening here? And he gets over to the piano and sits down and puts his cane down and hits that keyboard and played like a 20-year-old for 2 hours. The other four guys with him, you know, were the typical, I don't know what they were, saxophone, whatever. And at the break, he told them a little bit about the group. He said, we've been together for almost 50 years. So somebody says to him, how old are you? He goes, I'll be 104 next week. Every one of those guys was over 95. They got together, practiced during the week. You know, they took suggestions, requests from the audience, and somebody asked for Amazing Grace. They played variations nonstop for 15 minutes, and I was in complete tears. Amazing. So you guys better learn to play the drums or something and get together with a group in the garage and do something together, because you have a much higher rate of risk for midlife depression. And you don't have to have a prescription or take medicine for that. Next. So they're repeating this, supposedly. They want to do it with whites compared to Asians. Hispanics are considered white, so apparently they're not going to look at that group as separately. But they're going to do it with whites and Native Americans. So it's going to be interesting to me to see what happens. When they finished this big study, they came out with some recommendations. You know, my belief is that we have each been leased a brain and body to use on this planet. There is no evidence we're taking it anywhere with us. It's our job to take care of it. And so often we miss the ethic of love everyone and interpret it as, I don't care how abusive the situation is that I'm in, I've got to love this person and stay here. Well, if you had leased a Rolls Royce and it was in your garage and somebody came in and started scraping all over it with a key or breaking windows or whatever, do you think you just stand there and smile and say, well, you know, I got to love everybody? Yes, and you first take care of the brain and body God leased to you. And this research suggests that it is important to stop exposing yourself, especially to unpredictable stressors. You never know when that person's going to go off and start beating people up or whatever, especially when you don't really have any much control over it. That was one of the biggest things I faced as director of Napa County Health Department. We would take a woman out of her home. Usually the hospital would call us because she was in the ER with broken bones and whatever. And we put her in a safe house. And 3 or 4 months later, when she was healed and was ready to be released, where do you suppose she wanted to go? She goes back home because I must have done something. I'm going to try again. Maybe I'll get it right this time. That is a lie. If she goes back, she has an increased risk of being killed within 5 years, 80% risk. So we have to take a look at this. So what they suggested were key factors to look at were abusive, rageaholic people, a repeated pattern of cheating, because that can be very stressful, male or female, a relationship with an addiction, especially with pornography. Pornography actually changes the brain. Jobs where a customer may lash out or slam the door in your face. You know, some people seem to be able to handle that. For others, it's extremely stressful. A boss who flies into rages and demeans you, especially at meetings and in public, and that happens. Family or friends who continue to treat you badly. Doesn't mean you don't love them, but I have to set my boundaries with a few family members because after I'm around them for 2 or 3 hours, I go home and I'm depressed because they have been so unkind and demeaning and verbally abusive. So you need to take a look at your brain and body. You are just leasing it. And when you turn it back in, how has it been treated? I'm aiming to be at least a super centenarian. That's 110. Now, my body may not look like it does today, but it will be in the best shape that I've been able to keep it in shape. Because it's been leased to me. I don't own it. It's just carrying my brain around on this planet. Next slide. So, male strategies. Men understand, women understand that they tend to think what's happening in the moment is not that bad. Somebody said to me the other day, you know, the guys at PG&E don't think shutting off the electricity is that bad. Okay? Now, when something shows up and you see this difference between you and a female and you go, I don't think it's so bad, just get over it, stop. Ask her, what do you think is the worst thing that could happen? And if she trusts you, she'll tell you. And you go, boy, I don't think I thought about that. But then you, next slide, can help her realize that it's not as bad as she's seeing it. She might be blowing it out of proportion. And that's when, married or single, find a male that you trust, a brother, an uncle, maybe even the pastor, and talk, although he may not want any more people in his office to counsel, I don't know. Should have asked him first. To look at it from a male perspective and give you that perspective, because neither one of you see the picture correctly. Somewhere in the middle is the actual picture. Does that make sense? Okay, slide. Now, is stress transferable? This is scary. Studies have shown that stress can be transferred. Family members of those with PTSD sometimes show the same symptoms as those who have experienced the stress directly. In the prefrontal cortex, there are neurons called mirror neurons. And whatever you look at, those mirror neurons, it's like looking in a mirror, and they respond as if whatever you're seeing is actually happening to you. And that's the problem with scary movies, among other things. So, if you are around people who are acting out their stress, you will pick up that stress. They've also found that in instances of families where one child is bullying behaviors to the other siblings, which happens, the siblings who are watching the one who's actually being bullied have the same response as the person who's receiving the bullying behaviors. Next slide. The stress that's transmitted back and forth keep people from learning, interfere with memory functions, interfere actually with the way the brain is being developed, which is the reason that when pregnant women are really subjected to high levels of stress, different things can happen to the fetuses, but one of them, if it's a female fetus, is her brain will actually wire and template differently than it would have been if the pregnancy was calm and happy and the baby was wanted. So that little female will react to stress differently her entire life. Next slide. So last slide. Researchers say that stressors, as your brain perceives them, interacts with the brain in a predictable equation. That equation is only 20% of any negative impact to your brain and body is due to the stressor event. Read that with me. Stressors interact with the brain in a predictable equation. Only 20% of any negative impact to your brain and body is due to the stressor event. Anytime that you need to remember something, try to read it out loud, because it involves the entire brain and will likely go directly into short-term memory. All right, let's keep going. 80% is due to your perception of the event and the weight you give to it. When I was in Greece, I learned about Epictetus. He was a slave. Don't know how he got to be a slave, but he didn't like it. So he tried to run away, and he was caught. If you look his name up on Wikipedia, you'll see a picture of him. When he came back, his owner busted one of his legs in multiple places, and it never healed right, so he couldn't walk. Eventually, somehow, he became freed. And he then became a philosopher. He had someone who was with him all the time because he couldn't write and hang on to his crutch at the same time. But this scribe wrote down some interesting things he said. Interesting from my perspective. This is one of the things he said. And by the way, I put second century up here now. I was at a university talking to freshman students and trying to help them understand about stress and getting through their exams and not living a balanced lifestyle, and then they're sick for their vacation, which is no surprise. I said, I was in Greece recently and learned about Epictetus. And one of the hunks in the room said, well, Dr. Taylor, did you get to meet this Epictetus? So I always put second century up there now. He said, it's not so much what happens that matters as what you think about what happens. Does that not remind you of the story of Paul and Silas in that horrible Roman jail, shackled, don't know whether they're going to live or die? And what were they doing? Singing. What kind of songs? Praise songs. I'm still alive. Thank you. So when Paul says, be anxious for nothing, that's the prescription for stress management. Identify the problem, talk to somebody about it, do what you can, and let it go. Because it will impact your life negatively otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Let's have a closing prayer, and we'll continue our service at 11:15. Father in heaven, Lord, thank you so much for what we've heard. Continue to bless our hearts, Lord, our minds. Thank you for Dr. Taylor. Give her strength, Lord, as she presents, Lord, on this beautiful organ that you've given us, the brain. Is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.